30 years ago this past week, Ronald Reagan gave his farewell address to the American people. It was his 34th such address from the Oval Office, and the last one he would give before relinquishing the office to President Bush, number 41. As most of Ronald Reagan's speeches were, this one was filled with comfort and hope. It was filled with the ideals that he personally held, the aspirations that he had for America that once again had found its way in the world. Now, I'll be very honest in admitting that in the late 70s, the nation was on such a track and somewhat depressing that I didn't know exactly what might happen to the nation. We had gotten married in 1976 when Jimmy Carter was elected, or just before he was elected, President of the United States. And I'm sure deep down inside, Jimmy Carter was a very sincere individual. His presidency didn't work out so well. Maybe it was just circumstances in some ways, but we had a lot of problems towards the end of the 1970s. A lot of you are old enough to remember the Iran hostage crisis. And if you'll go back and take a look at our literature during that time, and the Good News and the Plain Truth magazine, you'll find a lot of articles. Some of my friends keep everything. They just keep everything that we have ever written. And they've gone back. I've gone back. I can access it online now. But you can go back and you can take a look at some of the pessimistic things that were being said in even our print literature regarding the future of America. And I'll have to admit that I did buy into it about the immediate future of the United States. And you tie that in with our general understanding of Bible prophecy, and there is just a general sense that, at least from the church standpoint, that the best days of America were over. And what we learned through the 1980s, I remember conducting a Bible study out in Midland, South Dakota, with a group of people there in central South Dakota. We had it at home of one of the elders. One of the farmers came up to me afterwards, and we were talking about current events and talking about what was going on. And it was towards 1987, 1988, and he said to me, "You know, Mr. Buchanan, I think we're going to look back on this decade and say it was actually pretty good." And he was so right. Because what happened during the presidency of Ronald Reagan was astounding for a lot of us in the church. Maybe just me. I don't think so. But thinking that in late 1979 and 1980 that the best days of America had been behind us, and then all of a sudden, the day that President Reagan was inaugurated, Iran announced that the hostages would be released, and they were after, what was it, well over 300 days, well over a year in captivity. And a dawning of a new decade began, and life began to get more positive. There was an economic recovery that lasted and has actually continued to last that began at that very time. There was innovation. There was incredible innovation and technological achievement through the 1980s. There was tremendous economic prosperity that began when, for those of you that aren't old enough to remember these times, mortgage rates in the late 1970s, late 1970s, were hovering around 20%. 20%! You were lucky to get a mortgage, even at between 15 and 20%. As you can imagine, home purchases were pretty far down during that time. That's an important segment of the economy. And sure, people made a lot of money on, you know, certificates of deposit, 12, 13%, and that sort of thing. But the other aspect of the economy was not so great. And we had, as a nation, lost our way, lost our path. But President Reagan was an inspirational figure for the people of the United States. Our nation in the 70s was certainly in turmoil. We had gone from a nation that had just begun to recover from Vietnam, the Watergate controversy, and then gradually transitioning to this taking over our embassy in the nation of Iran and everything that happened at that particular time. But new hope sprang forward with new leadership. I didn't think it would happen, to be honest with you. We can share about what your thoughts were at that time, especially if you were a member of the Church of God. The presidency of Ronald Reagan was noted for its opposition to communism. More on that in just a bit. It was noted for its economic recovery and the reestablishment of the United States as being very prominent in the world. I wrote in one of the World News and Prophecy updates that, at least at that time, I had the feeling and the idea and the thought that the fulfillment of prophecy was kind of like always on a gradual downhill slide. I may not have put it in those words, but, you know, this is bad. It gets worse and worse and worse and worse. It doesn't always happen that way. Sometimes there's a rebound. Sometimes with good leadership, things get better. And still the prophetic scene is being fulfilled all along as we inch closer and closer to the fulfillment of Bible prophecy and end-time Bible prophecy and eventually the return of Jesus Christ to this earth. The United States was established, maybe not in everybody's mind, but in a lot of folks' mind, as a symbol for good. And on that evening 30 years ago, the president spoke about a time when he and Nancy Reagan went to Moscow to visit President Gorbachev. And during that visit, during the latter part of their presidency, they went for a walk, and they kind of went off the beaten path in Moscow down a little side street, off one of the main shopping areas to some smaller shops. And you know what they found? They found that when the people that were on the streets, the Russian people saw them, they recognized them, and they came up with hopeful anticipation and reached out their arms in friendship and hope to the president and his wife. And then on that speech, in that speech 30 years ago, President Reagan mentioned that pretty soon the KGB came in and began to push the people back. And that moment was gone, that moment of affection and appreciation and hope. But it was a step. And he mentioned that as being one of the prominent things of his presidency. In the last 4 years of the presidency of Ronald Reagan, this is quite amazing. The approval rating that he had was extremely high, 60 to 70% when he left office. It doesn't happen that often. Because in a nation like we have, you know, that is always seemingly divided, left, right, north, south, Democrat, Republican, it's very hard for somebody to achieve that kind of approval rating. But most interesting was that with people under 30 years of age, he had the highest approval rating in that particular age group. For somebody that was 70 years old at the time or older when he left the office of the presidency, that is quite amazing that he could relate to people 50, 60 years younger than himself and have that kind of approval rating. One of the inspirations of Ronald Reagan's career was the imagery of America as a beacon of hope, truth, and opportunity. And he often invoked the example of a pilgrim by the name of John Winthrop, who was the first governor of the Massachusetts Bay Colony. And John Winthrop called the New World a city upon a hill. And Ronald Reagan seized that metaphor, made it his own in describing America. And all through his life, he called America the shining city on the hill. The shining city on a hill is a powerful image of God's plan of salvation, God's people, and everything that God is doing and has been doing on this earth. The title today is The Shining City on a Hill. If you'll turn with me to Matthew chapter 5, Matthew chapter 5 and verse 14, this is the place in the Sermon on the Mount, obviously, that you immediately think of when you think of this particular metaphor that Ronald Reagan used, and it's something that is very, very true, both in the individual sense, as Christ was describing it, in a group sense, in a national sense. In Matthew chapter 5 and verse 14, Christ said, "You are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hidden." So it's a metaphor. It's symbolic. You're not actually lights, are you? You're human beings. But Christ was saying, you are the light of the world, and a city that is set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do they light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. The life of the individual who is righteous, who's obedient to God, is called a light. And obviously you know that that's why you've been called of God. You have been called, and I have been called, to be lights. And we're also called to be a part of what Ronald Reagan said was a shining city on a hill. John Winthrop, the governor of the Massachusetts colony, and many other leaders of the early part of this nation who came to the United States from distant shores recognized something about this place. Now we're talking about a physical place. We're talking about what would become America. Something that was the blessing of a new world also brought the responsibility to the individual as well. Christ said, of course, you are the light of the world. And in verse 16, let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven. It's not that just the individual was special of and by himself. It was described by his good works. And that is what made him the light to the world, him or her. Now, several centuries after John Winthrop landed on the shores of Massachusetts, there was an individual who was a French sociologist and political theorist by the name of Alexis de Tocqueville. And he came to the United States on an extended journey because he wanted to study the prison system of the United States. He wanted to see how people were treated in our penitentiaries in this nation, and in some cases, he interviewed every single inmate in some prisons in Pennsylvania. But he went all across the United States. His primary objective before he came was to look at our prison system and see how it differed from what was happening in Europe. But what he left with was a work in which he wrote a book entitled Democracy in America. So he ended up with something in 1831 that was quite different than his stated objective. And he wrote in Democracy in America, "I sought for the greatness and the genius of America and her commodious harbors and her ample rivers, and it was not there." He traveled all over the then United States, by foot, by horseback, by trains where it was available, by rivers, and he traveled all over the United States, and he came back with this. He searched for the greatness and the genius of America. It wasn't in the ample rivers and the commodious harbors. He said, in her fertile fields and boundless forests, and it was not there. In her rich mines, in her vast world commerce, It wasn't in things physical. Here is a nation that was blessed with great physical comforts and opportunity and potential. And he saw all of that. He saw the great wide open spaces of this nation and all of the power and the potential that was there. He said, in her democratic Congress and her matchless Constitution, and it was not there. Not until I went into the churches of America and heard her pulpits aflame with righteousness, did I understand the secret of her genius and power. America is great because she is good. And if America ever ceases to be good, she will cease to be great. And I think perhaps as a secular prophet, this is one of the best. The idea that it was the good works of the people and the righteousness of the churches which described the power and the genius of the United States of America might be lost on a lot of people. It shouldn't be lost on any of us. And it shouldn't be in terms of the imagery and the symbolism, in terms of what that metaphor means to you and to me and to the members of the people of God. That, of course, we would know that if we ever cease to be good, we would cease to be great. Not that we're great of and by ourselves as a people. We're not. God's calling is great. What God has promised us is great. And what he will give us is greatness. Turn with me to Genesis chapter 4 and verse 6, because it is the simple and basic approach that God has had with individuals and groups of people and even nations that is similar all the way through the Bible. In this case, God is dealing with Cain face to face. And the English translation, or the King James translation, a New King James translation, is maybe not the clearest. I think you can get the sense of it, and you probably understand what it means. I'll read from the Good News translation. Then the Lord said to Cain, "Why are you angry? Why that scowl on your face?" You know, when people are angry, they don't walk around with a brimming smile and happy face, right? We show our emotions on our face a lot. Unless you're an actor, you can hide those emotions maybe, or you can hide your actual feelings. And I know I don't. I know that, when I have, and I'll say this for Lee's benefit. Lee has big eyes, my father-in-law, he's big eyes. Terry has big eyes, and we often can get, or they can, I know that this is not the way they feel at times, especially my father-in-law, Lee, but he gets this gaze and this intent gaze. Sorry to make an example of you, Lee, but you know, our families has got to be good for something. He will look and look, and he's a trained observer as a former police officer, and that intenseness of that gaze almost looks like he's upset, but he's not. Now, when I'm upset, I don't know about you, but I'm upset. It's all over me. I can't hide it. There's nothing I can do about it. My wife says, "You need to change the expression on your face." How do I do that? Well, I got to get happy or something. I mean, got to do. And I'll have that same intent gaze. Probably you do too. Probably all of us to some extent. Why just focus on me? Let's talk about you. Let's talk about you and how angry and upset you can get. So why that scowl on your face? If you had done the right thing, you'd be smiling. But because you have done evil, sin is crouching at your door, as if sin was a evil persona. Sin is there. It's present. Negative frame of mind, attitude, all very, very important. It, sin, wants to rule you, but you must overcome it. Cain did not. Cain did not overcome it, but he was still warned. In a similar way, God dealt with ancient Israel. Turn to Deuteronomy chapter 5. You see, the whole object here, in a way, pretty simple, is that God has wanted to make everybody a part of that shining city on a hill. And if you think of it as an individual, and no, you're not going to be a city unto yourself and everything, but you're a part of that citizenry, and you're a part of that whole thing, and you have your responsibility as an individual to be that way. That is your calling. That is your destiny. In Deuteronomy chapter 5 and verse 22, these words the Lord spoke to all your assembly. Now, Moses is recounting after 40 years. He's teaching them again to the generation that is going to enter into that land of promise. He's telling them something in a very similar way to the reaching out of Ronald Reagan that night of January 11th, 1989. You can look up the speech and you can read it in its entirety. I'll read a few more excerpts here before we're done today. But his speech was also a call to action for younger folks to remember some things. And it's similar to this that Moses was leaving with this new generation, or this younger generation that would go in to inherit the land. These words the Lord spoke to all your assembly in the mountain from the midst of the fire. Yeah, so remember those of you that are old enough 40 years ago when those Ten Commandments were given to us? Do you remember that? From the midst of the fire, the cloud, and the thick darkness with a loud voice, and he added no more. And he wrote them on two tablets of stone and gave them to me. So it was, when you heard the voice from the midst of the darkness, while the mountain was burning with fire, that you came near to me, all the heads of your tribes and your elders. And you said, surely the Lord our God has shown us his glory and his greatness, and we have heard the voice from the midst of the fire. We have seen this day that the Lord speaks with man, yet he still lives. Now, therefore, why should we die? For this great fire will consume us if we hear the voice of our Lord God any more, then we shall die. For who is there of all the flesh who heard the voice of the living God speaking from the midst of the fire as we have and lived? You go near and hear all the word, all the Lord our God may say, and tell us all that the Lord your God says to you, and we will hear and do it. Then the Lord heard the voice of your words which you spoke to me and said to me, I have heard the voice of the words of this people which they have spoken to you. They are right in all that they have spoken. They are right in all they have spoken. They got it at that particular time, at least temporarily. And then God said, oh, that they had such a heart in them that they would fear me and always keep all my commandments, that it might be well with them and with their children forever. That is what God wants for everyone eventually. This was the teaching that was given to the generation that would go in to inherit the land. And the message is really the same one. The words are a little bit different here, but it is still the same one. You are the shining city on a hill to those that were going in. Going into the land, you're the shining city on the hill. In Deuteronomy 4, just a few pages back, take a look here. Deuteronomy 4 and verse 1. Now, O Israel, listen to the statutes and the judgments which I teach you to observe, that you may live and go in and possess the land which the Lord your God of your fathers is giving you. You shall not add to the word which I command you, nor take from it, that you may keep the commandments of the Lord your God which I command you. Your eyes have seen what the Lord did at Baal Peor, for the Lord your God has destroyed from among you all the men who followed the Baal of Peor. But you who held fast to the Lord your God are alive today, every one of you. Surely I have taught you statutes and judgments, just as the Lord my God commanded me, that you should act according to them in the land which you go in to possess. Christ's admonition in Matthew 5 is accompanied by the instruction is of being a light to the world in a city that is set on a hill that cannot be hid, is also accompanied by the instruction to do right in verse 16. Just the same exact message that God gave to ancient Israel, the same exact message that resonates to all of us today. Verse 6, therefore be careful to observe them, for this is your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the people, who will hear all these statutes and say, surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people. For what great nation is there that has God so near to it as the Lord our God is with us, for whatever reason we may call upon him? And what great nation is there that has such statutes and righteous judgments as are all in this law which I set before you this day? Your wisdom doesn't come from your genealogy. It doesn't come from anything else but that which God gives you to obey. Only take heed to yourself and diligently keep yourself, lest you forget the things your eyes have seen. It is so easy to forget, as history records for us. It is so easy to forget the things that are really pretty simple. Diligently keep yourself, lest you forget the things your eyes have seen, and lest they depart from your heart all the days of your life, and teach them to your children and your grandchildren, especially concerning the day that you stood before the Lord your God in Horeb, when the Lord said to me, gather all the people to me, and I will let them hear my words, that they may learn to fear me all the days that they live on the earth, and that they may teach their children. And then you'll remember that we just covered the part where the people couldn't hear, they couldn't stand the voice of God, so Moses relayed the information to them. And they said, all of this we will do. And God said, oh, that they would have such a heart in them to be that. What was he saying? Oh, that they would be that city on a hill that would be an example to all the nations around. God was going to clear the way, send hornets in, drive all the pagan peoples out of the land of Palestine, out of the land of Israel. They were to go in there, set up shop, listen to these words, obey them. And then it didn't happen, and God knew it wouldn't happen, of course. But then wouldn't it have been very interesting if for longer than just a short period of time, Israel had been that model nation, that shining city on the hill that had the light of God's law and broadcast that out to the entire earth? It did for a little while, when the kingdom was united under David, and for a little while under Solomon. Queen of Sheba came up and observed everything, took some of the knowledge, took it all back to Ethiopia, and there remains a Christian community. Now, it's not like we know Christianity, but she took it back. And they still have reverence for the Bible in that city because of her trek. It wasn't completed, but it was still an example of what can happen when something good is done. Of course, Solomon wasn't the best example for much of his life, as we know. But being an example was and is important, not just for a nation, but for an individual. That's where you come in. That's where I come in. So President Reagan said in that speech a little bit further on, I really believe he was reaching out to the demographic that really admired him the most. Now, it's a given that older folks, the greatest generation, would admire him. But his greatest appeal was with the people who were 30 years and under in age. And this was like a clarion call to them. Think about this. We've got to teach history based on not on what's in fashion, but what's important. Why the pilgrims came here, who Jimmy Doolittle was, and what those 30 seconds over Tokyo meant. Have you ever read about the story of Jimmy Doolittle and his raid on Tokyo after Pearl Harbor? It's an amazing story. It is an incredible story. It was, I think it was B-17 bombers. Now, during the early part of World War II, the aircraft carrier was still kind of in its infancy. But in order to get close enough to Japan to strike back at the Japanese forces, they had to take apart, and I may be wrong on the type of bomber it was. It was an early bomber of World War II. I think it was the B-17s. I'm just recounting this from memory. They had to take those apart, store them in the aircraft carrier. Never before in history had a plane so huge taken off from an aircraft carrier. These were bombers, mind you. So as they got closer, I think within about 600 miles of Japan, they had to reassemble the planes within the ship, bring them up on deck, and then with the waves crashing and these early aircraft carriers going up and down and up and down, their mission, and they all had to volunteer, Jimmy Doolittle was the head of the Army Air Corps at that particular time, and he was a famous pilot from World War I and throughout, but he enlisted men to fly these planes to do something that had never been done before. And they flew off these aircraft carriers, and somehow, I think all of them survived that takeoff, which was touch and go. And their mission was they were to bomb Japan, bomb Tokyo, and then fly into China and ditch the planes or land them at some place. And some of them made it, some of them didn't. But it's an amazing story if you read about it, and it was one of the pivotal things that occurred in our war in the Pacific theater in the early part of World War II. And it put the world on notice, and certainly the Japanese on notice at that particular time, that, you know, the big dog is going to fight back. Very, very interesting. How many of you ever heard that story in history in school? Yeah, probably not too many of us. You know, 4 years ago on the 40th anniversary of D-Day, I read a letter from a young woman writing to her late father who fought on Omaha Beach. Her name was Lisa Zanetta Henn, and she said, "We will always remember, we will never forget what the boys of Normandy did." But let's help her keep her word. That was a kind of a call to remember history and to teach it in our schools. He goes on to say, if we forget what we did, we won't know who we are. I am warning of an eradication of that, of the American memory that could result ultimately in an erosion of the American spirit. It's almost biblical. In terms of what it is telling the nation, in terms of telling people to remember where they came from. So again, the generation of people that Ronald Reagan had the greatest approval rating with was the people who would become the educators, ironically, and would be teaching. This is 30 years ago now. And when you see the when you see the results of like the man on campus reports, when people are young people today who are the product of those 30 years old, 20 to 30 years old, who would become parents and teachers, you can see that this particular warning from Ronald Reagan basically went unheeded. It's kind of unfortunate. In Deuteronomy chapter 31, this is, I guess, just a generational thing, but it's at certain periods of time when people recognize who they are and they try to pass on that information to the younger generation, sometimes it gets lost. Sometimes it goes unheeded. Doesn't mean it didn't happen. Just means that it didn't resonate somehow or another. It wasn't retained. It's got to be one of those generational anomalies and problems. Deuteronomy chapter 31 and verse 28. Moses said, "Gather to me all the elders of your tribes and your officers, that I may speak these words in their hearing, and call heaven and earth to witness against them." You read the preceding chapter as a restatement of some of the history of Israel and what Moses did, what God did with Israel. This almost sounds like what Paul said to the Ephesian elders when he left Ephesus in Acts 20. He said, "For I know that after my death you will become utterly corrupt and turn aside from the way which I have commanded you, and evil will befall you in the latter days, because you will do evil in the sight of the Lord and provoke him to anger through the work of your hands." This is what Moses told them. He spoke in the hearing of all the assembly of Israel the words of the song until they were ended. Several of us were visiting with Mr. LaRavia earlier this week. Some of you here remember. So we were talking, and I was reminded of something that my friend Wolfgang, who we've recently reconnected, told me. I hope you don't mind me sharing this story, that in the latter stages of his ministry, some of you remember that you heard this on tape, or you know that he said this, but Mr. Armstrong was in Germany for a church visit. Wolfgang told me via email that he and his wife were in the choir. They were sitting up close. And in the latter stages of his ministry, Mr. Armstrong said several times, "You're not getting it. You're not getting it." And I was talking to Mr. LaRavia about this earlier this week. And, of course, he was there by his side on several of these trips that he made and remembers better than all the rest of us do how Mr. Armstrong said this. Now, here's the interesting thing. If you did not know this, Mr. Armstrong was not a people person. His access to you, to me, to anybody who was out in Pasadena even, was very limited. I mean, Mr. Armstrong, this is not a judgment or anything, but of his age and everything, I mean, he's in his 80s and 90s. In the decade of the 80s, and he died in 1986. But he would be brought from his home on the western side of the campus, brought down to the auditorium in a car. Somebody would drive him. He would be brought in to the auditorium through the backstage. It wasn't like we all do here when we arrive at services and we're shaking everybody's hands and talking with each other and all that sort of thing. He really didn't have much access to, and afterwards, it was the same thing. Off stage, out of the auditorium, back to his home. I mean, he was in his 80s and 90s during those years, okay? So, but he was never really somebody that was out there for many, many years, kind of pressing the flesh, as they like to say in the political parlance. But in a very prescient way, Mr. Armstrong got it. Somehow, I believe God must have inspired this in his head, because we saw what happened in the mid-90s when people had a choice to choose. Many of them, more than half, chose to go in a way that was contrary to the way that you chose. He said, "You're not getting it." Maybe the words that Moses spoke here and that Paul spoke to the Ephesian elders in Acts 20, maybe it provokes some action on the part of a few. And sometimes that's what it takes to get people going. One last chance, one last warning. Maybe somebody will listen this particular time. Who knows? In chapter 32, This is an amazing prophecy and a history lesson. Chapter 32 and verse 1, "Give ear, O heavens, and I will speak, and hear, O earth, the words of my mouth. Let my teaching drop as the rain, and my speech distill as the dew, as raindrops on the tender herb and as showers on the grass. For I proclaim the name of the Lord. Ascribe greatness to our God. He is the rock. His work is perfect. For all of his ways are justice, a God of truth and without injustice. Righteousness, righteous and upright is his, is he rather. They have corrupted themselves. They are not his children because of their blemish, a perverse and crooked generation. Do you thus deal with the Lord, O foolish and unwise people? Is he not your father who brought you? Has he not made you and established you? Remember the days of old and consider the years of many generations. Ask your father and he will show you, your ruler, your elders, and they will tell you. When the Most High divided their inheritance to the nations, when he separated the sons of Adam, he set the boundaries of the peoples according to the number of the children of Israel." It certainly seems that from the beginning, God had a plan. It seems from here and what he is saying that the nation's boundaries were determined by God after he determined where Israel would be. It shows the claim on the land that God decides where to put this group of people or this nation of people. For the Lord's portion is his people, and Jacob is the place of his inheritance. He found him in a desert land, in the wasteland, a howling wilderness. He encircled him. He instructed him. He kept him as the apple of his eye. He's speaking about him, like him as the individual, but it's talking about a group of people, a nation of people. As an eagle stirs up its nest, hovers over its young, spreading out its wings, taking them up, carrying them on its wings, so the Lord led him, and there was no foreign God with him. He made him ride in the heights of the earth, that he might eat the produce of the fields, and made him draw honey from the rock, and oil from the flinty rock, curds from the cattle, and milk of the flock. Blessings upon material blessings given, with the fat of lambs, and the rams of the breed of Bashan and goats, with the choicest wheat, and you drank the wine, the blood of the grapes. It's a history of what God did with a people in small beginnings with individuals and then grew, and then a prophecy of what they would get later on after they went into the promised land, and then a prophecy further on about how they would throw it all aside, beginning in verse 15. You forsake God. You can continue on and read through the rest of the chapter. History and a prophecy of what would happen. Verse 16, they provoked him to jealousy with foreign gods. With abominations, they provoked him to anger. You know, that happened later throughout the history of Israel. It's quite amazing. Now, you can read the rest of it. It's the I've invoked this several times in some of the prophecy updates, the blessings. It's one of the blessings and cursings chapter, and you can read the rest. But there's some beautiful prophecy in the next chapter, which chapter 33 shows shows what happens at the beginning, actually at the return of Jesus Christ in verse 2 of chapter 33. The Lord came from Sinai and dawned on them from Seir. He shone forth from Mount Paran, and he came with 10,000s of his saints. From his right hand came a fiery law for them. Yes, he loves the people. All his saints are in your hand. They sit down at your feet. Everyone receives your words. This group has listened. And that is what gives me, and I hope you, hope for the future. The Lord comes with 10,000s of his saints. All through history, God has dealt with mankind, called people to salvation, and they are the shining city on the hill. They've heard the clarion call to action, and they have instituted these laws and these demands that God gives for the benefit of everyone to that individual and that individual response. Somehow or another, If you go back to the previous chapter and what would happen to the people of God, verse 13, actually, this is where I want to go. Chapter 33 and verse 13. And of Joseph he said, blessed be the Lord in his land, with the precious things of heaven with the dew, and the deep lying beneath. These are the material blessings I've written about, would be withheld for 2,520 years. It began to come to pass in the early 1800s. The deep lying beneath, and the precious fruits of the sun, with the precious produce of the months, with the best things of the ancient mountains, with the precious things of the everlasting hills, with the precious things of the earth and its fullness, and the favor of him who dwelt in the bush. Let the blessing come on the head of Joseph, and on the crown of the head of him who is separate from his brothers. All of Israel is mentioned here, but Joseph is singled out. Jacob, Joseph, Ephraim, Manasseh, they're singled out in a special way. Let the blessing come on the head of Joseph and on the crown of the head of him who was separate from his brothers. His glory is like the firstborn bull, and his horns like the horns of the wild ox. Together with them, he shall push the peoples to the ends of the earth. They are the 10,000s of Ephraim, and they are the thousands of Manasseh. Control the destiny of all mankind has been, in the last 200 years, the work of Joseph. And somehow, at the beginning of our nation, the people who came here knew that they were fulfilling this destiny and this prophecy. Now, I don't know if they could have turned to this chapter and say, yeah, that's who we are, and this is what we are going to do. No, I'm not saying that. No, no, don't get me wrong. But instinctively, they knew enough of the Bible to realize that they were different and that they were special. It didn't understand the United States, British Commonwealth, and prophecy or anything like that. But it became clear to them early on that what was happening in the New World had never happened before in the history of mankind. And they were individuals like this John Winthrop who were steeped in understanding the imagery and the symbolism of the Bible and applying it to themselves with the kind of anticipation and hope and enduring many, many hardships, realizing that they were establishing something that would become a foundation for even better things. And as they were coming across the Atlantic, on the deck of the ship, John Winthrop wrote, "We shall find that the God of Israel is among us, when he shall make us a praise and a glory, that men of succeeding generations shall say, the Lord make it like that of New England. For we must consider that we shall be as a city upon a hill. The eyes of all the people are upon us." And it was that speech that so motivated President Reagan. And he made it his own. And he invoked it several times through his various campaigns. I don't know if he used it when he was campaigning to become the governor of California in the early 60s or the mid-60s. But just a century after John Winthrop, there was a religious revival that spread across New England. Now, that religious revival didn't understand a lot of things. We know that the Puritan preachers believed in a condemnatory God, and so they didn't have that quite right. But they had religion of some kind. And it was a religion that taught people obedience to the law. And that's the only thing to remember at that time. But Jonathan Edwards supposed that he was living, as he wrote, in the latter days wherein we may be especially warranted to expect that new things will be accomplished. And if these things are so, it gives us more abundant reason to hope that it is now seen in America, and especially in New England, may prove the dawn of that glorious day. I'd like to read another excerpt from a speech from Ronald Reagan as he was closing. He said, "And that's about all I have to say tonight except for one thing. The past few days When I've been at that window upstairs, that is the residence upstairs from the Oval Office, I thought a bit about the shining city on a hill. That phrase comes from John Winthrop, who wrote it to describe the America he imagined. What he imagined was important because he was an early pilgrim, an early freedom man. He portrayed here on what today we'd call, on what today we'd call a little wooden boat. And like other pilgrims, he was looking for a home that would be free. I've spoken of the shining city all my political life, but I don't know if I ever quite communicated what I saw when I said it. But in my mind, it was a tall, proud city built on rocks stronger than oceans, windswept, God-blessed, and teeming with people of all kinds living in harmony and peace, a city with free ports that hummed with commerce and creativity. And if there had to be city walls, the walls had doors. And the doors were open to anyone with the will and heart to get here. That's how I saw it and see it still. How stands the city? In other words, in what shape was America today in 1989? And how stands the city on this winter night? More prosperous and more secure and happier than it was 8 years ago. That is true. It's a profound effect on a nation. But more than that, after 200 years, two centuries, she still stands strong and true on the granite ridge, and her glow has held steady no matter what storm. And she's still a beacon, still a magnet for all who must have freedom, for all pilgrims from all the lost places who are hurtling through the darkness toward home. We've done our part. And as I walk off into the city streets, a final word to the men and women of the Reagan Revolution, the men and women across America who for 8 years did the work that brought America back. My friends, we did it. We weren't just marking time. We made a difference. We made the city stronger. We made the city freer, and we left her in good hands. All in all, not bad, not bad at all. And so goodbye. God bless you, and God bless the United States of America. And so concluded the last speech of Ronald Reagan. Now, 30 years after that great speech, and three decades after the Church of God was set back on track and warned, because I think sometimes there has been a parallel action within the church and in within society, just a privately held feeling, doesn't always hold true, but some of you are old enough, some of you lived here during the times when Mr. Armstrong was living here in Tucson. And there finally came a time when it was safe for him to go back to the state of California. And he wrote often about setting the church back on track and reminding the church of some of the things that God had given to the Church of God. And I think about these words and think back to that time and both what Ronald Reagan and Mr. Armstrong did, and the meaning of their words that they still hold today. Turn with me to Ephesians chapter 5. Ephesians chapter 5, and beginning in verse 8. Just a few little reminders here as we close. For you were once in darkness, but now you are the light of the world. Walk as children of the light. For the fruit of the Spirit is in all goodness, righteousness, and truth. That is the responsibility of the individual that hears the message, that understands it's your job to be a light. It's your job to set the example. It doesn't really matter what happens all around you. It's really of no consequence. There's not going to be a time which anyone can say, you know, at that point in time, the church wasn't perfect. You know what? It never will be until we're all perfected. And I've reviewed the history and gone over my mind time and time again. And you know what? The church has never been perfect. There were times in which we have a warm, fuzzy glow and hey, things were really great then. No, there were things wrong then. You just didn't know it. There are a lot of things you didn't know back in the day, many of you. We look back sometimes, you got the rose-colored glasses on. No. No, there was never a perfect time in the church, nor will there ever be a perfect time in the church, and the church is not perfect now. You just live with it. You just live with it, and you realize, hey, you're still given this word. You can't say, well, the church wasn't good. You know, these guys were making, these ministers are doing this, they're doing that, they're making these decisions. No. No, you can't claim that. You can't say that. God places you in the body, you still have your job. I have my job, you have your job. We all have a job. Philippians chapter 2, verse 15. That you may become blameless and harmless children of God, walking without fault in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation, among whom you shine as the lights of the world. You know, it just doesn't even really matter how big or small the church is. I mean, church was much larger when I got here in 1988. Much, much larger. Sierra Vista was a lot larger than all three areas that we have together now. You realize that? Average attendance of 80 people. People move away. People die. People fall away. It doesn't change our responsibility. It doesn't mean anything. Our job, our calling, the legacy we leave on this earth, and following through on this calling to be the shining city of the hill always remains the same. You can't point to this area or that area and say, things are not perfect and I can't do this. No, you can do this. You can always do it. It doesn't matter what goes on below you or above you. It's your job. Your job. Isaiah chapter 2 and verse 2. Eventually, what's the end result of all of this is it comes to here. I mean, it's not the total end. We'll get to the total end in a minute. But it comes to this. I mean, going forward into the future, this is where it ends up. I mean, at least it doesn't end up, but it arrives at this particular destination. Verse 2, now it shall come to pass in the latter days that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established on the top of the mountains, and shall be exalted above the hills, and all nations shall flow to it. Why? Because they see the shining city on a hill. It's not a place. It's not a destination. This is a metaphor as well for God's way of life. Many people shall come and say, come and let us go to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. He will teach us his ways, and we shall walk in his paths. The same message resonates throughout history and in prophecy today. And then in Revelation 21, the ultimate fulfillment. I want to ask you before you turn there and begin reading this, what do you see in your head? What do you see in your mind's eye when you read about the New Jerusalem in Revelation chapter 21? What do you see? In Revelation 21 and verse 10, it describes something. If you are thinking of a physical location, you're on the wrong path. You're all wet. This is not talking about something that you can envision as John did. It's not talking about that at all. It's, again, symbols and imagery of a shining city on a hill. He carried me away to the Spirit, in the Spirit, to a great and high mountain, and he showed me the great city, the holy Jerusalem, descending out of heaven from God. Oh, wait a minute. Descending out is a city. This is an orb, a cube, or something, a pyramid. No! This is the shining city. This is the light on the hill. This is the people of God. This is the family of God. It's not a set of collection of buildings. This is all symbolic. Having the glory of God, a physical entity, does not have the glory of God. Her light was like the most precious stone, like jasper alone, clear as crystal. Also, she had a great and high wall with 12 gates. And 12 angels at the gates, and names written on them, which are the names of the 12 tribes of the children of Israel. 3 gates on the east, 3 gates on the north, 3 gates on the south, 3 gates on the west. Oh, yeah, it's talking about a city with foundations. You know, those foundations are described in song. You know, it's the love of God and the law of God. And all of this is describing a people that are totally absorbed the word of God and made it their own in their lives and have been obedient to it. It is the family of God. It is not the city in a physical sense that we think of. It is the final realization of the shining city on a hill. In verse 23, it says that this city had no need of the sun or the moon to shine on it, for the glory of God illuminated it. The Lamb is its light. And the nations of those. Okay, now we're getting down to it. It's the nations. It's everyone who has ever lived. Are saved, shall walk in its light. And the kings of the earth bring their glory and honor into it. Into that family. Into that group. What might the next 30 years of our physical lives hold? I have no idea. You don't either. But I'll tell you, there have been certain times in the history of the church when the people of God have been galvanized into action. I remember one time during the receivership crisis, when Mr. LaRavia will remember this, we talked about this a few months ago, the receiver said, wrote a letter to send to all the people. That's when we had snail mail. We all got a letter, said, make sure you send your tithes and your offerings into Pasadena. And at that time, the Church of God set up an office here in Tucson, Arizona, and the communication went out from Mr. Armstrong, who lived here, who was sent out to all the brethren, send your tithes and offerings to Tucson, Arizona. The receiver, can't even remember his name, Ellis will remember, he didn't get the money. But I remember during those days, you had to physically show up at a bank to cancel a check. I don't write that many checks much anymore, but I went down to the bank in downtown Austin, Texas, and there in line ahead of me were three other church members, all in the cancellation check office. Austin City Bank or whatever the name of that bank was. God's people respond in the right way at the right time to the right things. And 20 years ago, that happened as well. Over 20 years ago, that happened. It was very, very, very heartwarming. Action that is predicated on training, understanding, love, and compassion. And like Ronald Reagan, that's what gives me hope. Because I know that God's people will always be the shining city on a hill.